She opened her eyes, raised her hand, and struggled to say something. Alive. She'd survived. We'd done it. I felt oddly numb. My father sat on the ground next to me and gently touched one of the flowers. Gazdek knelt by Rowena, took her into his arms with infinite care, and carried her away. The boar's corpse sprawled on the ash, all of its flesh stripped, the great bones rolling gently as the lion dug into its stomach. The awful chewing sounds of a huge predator eating echoed through King's Row. A part of me knew this was Curran, and he was eating a god, and I should be freaked out by it. But most of me refused to deal with it. I was spent.
"Has the creature spoken to you?"
my father asked. "Yes. He wants to conquer."
"So did his brother. What else did he say?"
"He offered for me to be his queen. He wants me to betray you. He hasn't gotten around to saying it, but he will."
"What did you tell him?"
"I reminded him that my father and my aunt killed his brother and destroyed his army, so he was a losing bet. He told me he wasn't his brother and promised to prove it. This is his proof." I turned to him. "He has the Yetimur." A muscle jerked in my father's face.
"They are an abomination."
So the great and powerful Nimrod had a weakness after all. Is he really a dragon? Was his brother a dragon?
Yes.
Great. Freaking fantastic. He said his brother proposed marriage to Era. My father sneered, and I saw his older sister in his face.
"We don't marry serpents. We erase them from the flow of history."
"Oh, good." We sat quietly for a long moment.
"Tell me of the dragon," Roland asked.
"His name is Naig. He ruled Ireland and Scotland with his army of human soldiers and corrupted creatures. When the magic weakened, he retreated into the mists with his army. Now he's back. He took people from towns on the edge of Atlanta and boiled them for their bones."
"The tie that binds."
I looked at him.
"His kind makes their lairs in pockets of reality. A small fold in the fabric of time and space," Roland said. "They are creatures of immense magic, and they warp the natural order of things to make their homes. This Naig has taken his troops with him into his lair. They exist within it for so long, they themselves become bound to it. The warped magic permeated them and changed them. The magic here isn't ample enough to sustain him or his army, not unless the wave is quite potent. He and his forces must absorb the magic of our reality to reattune themselves. Humans are magic and numerous.
They eat the human bones so they can manifest here when the magic is weaker?
Drink them, most likely. Grind them into dust with magic and mix them with milk. A barbaric practice."
I rubbed my face. Simple explanations were usually correct ones. Consuming people would be logistically difficult. Too much mass. Bone powder made more sense. "Here is your bone smoothie. Great way to start the day." I wanted to vomit. Roland reached out and stroked my shoulder.
"Most of them never deal with us, but those who choose to mix with humans are a plague on this world. A plague I will one day cure."
"Father?"
"Yes, Blossom."
"If he has to drink this bone powder to manifest during magic, how many people will he have to kill to survive through tech?"
"Hundreds of thousands," my father said.
"Can I enter this pocket realm and kill him?"
"You can't enter without permission."
"What if he gave me permission?"
"You would be very foolish to enter."
"But if I did?"
I forbid it.
Uh-huh. That and a dollar would get him a cup of bad coffee. He wasn't exactly in a position to forbid me anything.
Roland softened his voice. If somehow you end up within his domain, do not eat or drink. If you consume something, it will anchor you to his realm, and you will be subject to his power for a short while. It would wear off unless he continued to feed you. As long as you don't eat anything he presents to you, you can leave at will, and nothing within his lair can hurt you. Simply wish to be back here, and the mists will tear, and you will be back in our world. In his realm, you are a ghost. You can't be hurt, but you cannot hurt him in return. But it's not a place you should ever visit, Blossom. Dragons are unpredictable, and their command of magic surpasses ours. They're good at manipulation.
Curran raised his huge head. His mouth was bloody. He staggered from the corpse, a huge, nightmarish beast, too big to be real. He sent his champion to fight me, I told him.
Where is the champion now?
Dead, my father smiled. You sent assassins to murder your grandson, your only grandson. They wanted to kill him and eat him. You are despicable, father. How do you look at yourself in the mirror in the morning?
What happened to the assassins?
I killed them.
I know, he said.
I felt them die.
Your own grandson! He smiled at me again.
The Sahanu were growing troublesome.
I stared at him, speechless. Wow. Just wow. You used me to clean up your cult?
He shrugged.
You used me to rescue a woman who betrayed me. I'd say we're even. Besides, my grandson was never in danger. You are my daughter, Blossom, one of a kind.
We are not even. Not even close. Do not come after Conlan again. I swear I will kill you. A strange contortion gripped the lion's body. He arched his back, then jerked his head to the sky. His great maw gaped open. The sun reflected on his fangs, which were longer than my legs. He roared, his eyes blazing with gold. A nimbus of pale silver twisted around him, crackling with violent energy. Two protrusions burst from his back. He snarled, and the protrusions unfolded into black wings. That's it. I'm done. The mercs screamed and howled. The look on Barabbas's face could have launched a fleet of spaceships.
Some are born to godhood, Roland said. Others attain it. I cautioned you against marrying him.
The lion walked to us. Wind whispered. My father was gone. The grass where he'd sat was slowly springing back. The lion stopped in front of me. He folded his wings, lowered his colossal head, and slowly, carefully, laid down on the grass, his face to me. He could have taken me whole into his mouth, and there would still be room for 10 more people. Is he silver? I asked. Nobody said anything. Is he silver? I repeated, raising my voice. Yes, Julie whispered. I got up, turned my back, and walked away from him.
Do you want to talk about it?
I lay on the edge of the woods, the grass soft under me. The scar of King's Row lay a few yards away. The sky above me was a beautiful blue, and cute little clouds floated here and there, like fluffy little sheep chasing each other in a vast pasture.
Baby,
Curran sat next to me. He'd ripped through his clothes during his dramatic transformation. He'd scrounged up a pair of shorts somewhere, but the rest of him was naked. His hair fell on his shoulders in a blonde mane. I turned my head and looked at him. To say that Kern worked out would be like saying that a marathon runner occasionally jogged. His body was a meld of strength and flexibility that translated into explosive power. He had a raw, feral edge that drew me to him like iron to a magnet. I knew that body intimately, and right now, it was bigger, taller, with broader shoulders, crisp definition, heartbreaking proportions, corded with steel-hard muscle. He was perfect. No human was perfect. He must have been perfect for a while. Funny how I hadn't noticed it before, probably because I loved him. To me, he'd always been perfect, with all of his flaws. I turned back to look at the sky. A muscular arm blocked my view of the clouds. He was offering to let me punch him in the arm. I raised my hand, moved his arm out of the way, and studied the clouds. "It's not that bad," he said. "How many animal gods have you eaten besides the tiger in my dad's castle and Makus back there?" "Four." "Yep, exactly what I thought." "Funny how that's the exact number of your hunting expeditions." He didn't say anything. And my aunt had encouraged him. Not that surprising, since she'd never liked him. The betrayal stung. He reached out to touch my shoulder. I slid out of the way. "Kate, you're a god. You're no longer human. Your thoughts and your behavior are no longer your own. With all of the things my screwed-up family has done, they've always steered clear of godhood, like it was on fire. And you jumped into the flames. You've lost your humanity, Curran. You don't control yourself anymore. You are controlled by the faith of the people who pray to you. What happens when the magic wave ends? What if you disappear?" He opened his mouth. I sat up. "I just want to know why. Conlon and I weren't enough for you? What did you want?"
"Power," he said.
"I thought you loved us."
"I love you more than anything."
"I understand if it wasn't enough. It's fucked up, but I get it. But you have a responsibility to your son. How could you?" I didn't look at him.
"Why the white warlock?" he asked.
"What?"
"Why do you need the white warlock?"
"Ah, the best defense is a good offense. The witches and I need her for the ritual to weaken my father and put him into a coma. For it to work, we need someone to channel the collective power of the covens. I can't be that person. My power is too different, but she can."
"And what happens if the ritual fails?"
"Who snitched?" He sighed.
"Nobody. I saw it in your eyes when we fought your father. How about your responsibility as a wife and mother? What about that?"
"What about it?"
"You'll kill yourself, or you'll kill him, and that will kill you. Either way, you're going to leave me and our son. Do you think Conlon will care that you sacrificed yourself? Is it going to comfort him when he's crying because you're not there?"
"He'll be alive to cry. You'll be alive. That's all I care about. My dad and I are bound. As long as one of us lives, the other does too. Do you think I want this?" I turned to him. "I would do anything for just a little more time. 10 years, 5, 1. Any time at all to be with you both. But he is coming. He already tried to kill Conlon. The only way to keep him safe is to take my father out of the equation."
"Roland won't be the only enemy Conlon will have."
"Yes, but right now he is the worst. I don't want to do it, Curran. I'm not looking forward to it. But if I have to die so our son can live, so my father is stopped, then I'll kill that son of a bitch. Even if I die too."
"I gathered,"
he said, his voice dry. "If I have to do it,
Don't try to stop me. He reached out and took my hand. I let him.
I won't stop you, he said. It's your life. It's your choice what you do with it. I've tried to stop you from doing things in the past, and it's never worked. It's pointless. You will do what you will do.
I had expected a fight. This was too easy. He gave me his beast lord stare.
But if I agree to this, you have to accept that I will do everything in my power to make sure things don't go that far.
Including becoming a god?
Including that. I needed an upgrade. This was the only way to get it.
But you're not you, Curran. He grinned, showing me his teeth.
Still me.
Bullshit. Have you seen Barabbas's face? What happens when shapeshifters start worshipping you?
They won't have the chance. It's all coming to a head one way or another.
He said it with an awful finality. There was no way back from godhood. It was terminal. It would eat at him slowly but surely, gradually changing him until the man I loved disappeared. He knew it, and he went through with it anyway. He had done it for me. He'd given up his free will so I would survive. Oh, Curran. If we somehow survived, I would stay with him forever, living for the glimpses of my old Curran in the god. What happens when the tech hits?
Nothing will happen. Era has been gauging my divinity. There isn't enough to make me a god yet. I'll be fine.
He pulled me to him, wrapping his arms around me, and inhaled my scent.
I'll never let you go.
I put my face into the crook of his neck. You have to.
No.
He kissed my hair.
You and me, Kate. We're forever. Conlon will grow up and go his own way, and you and I will still be here squabbling over who is going to save whom.
He held me while I cried quietly into his shoulder and wished with everything I had for a life I wasn't going to get. What good is immortality if the people you love can't be there with you? For the first time in my life, I wished magic had never come. Finally, I stopped. The tears had only lasted for a couple of minutes, but it had felt like an eternity. We'll have to tell the Conclave, I said. Curran grimaced.
Yes, they won't like it. They would accept a fire mage, but a dragon isn't something they can cope with.
I knew it. Luther had explained it to me once. We lived in an age of chaos, never knowing if magic or tech would have the upper hand, or what they would throw at us. The human mind wasn't built to cope with constant uncertainty. Instead, it sought to find order and consistency, some pattern, some sort of logical equation where a certain consequence always followed a specific event. Water evaporated when heated to a boiling point. The sun rose in the east and set in the west. All magic waves eventually ebbed. We managed to distill rules out of chaos. These core beliefs kept us sane, and we protected them at all costs. Otherwise, the house of logic built on these foundations fell apart, and we tumbled into madness. An elder being can't manifest unless there is a flare, was a core belief. A dragon was an overwhelming being, a creature of so much power and devastation that nothing in our arsenal could match it. It was like the idea of being hit by a meteorite. Theoretically, we were aware that a burning space rock could fall out of the sky at any moment and kill us, but we refused to dwell on this possibility. The idea that a dragon could manifest at any time and attack the city, and there was no defense against it, was so frightening that our brains stepped on the brake, rejecting the possibility. And this dragon wasn't just manifesting. He was smart and cunning. He had an army and wanted to invade.
We would need ironclad evidence to pull the Conclave's collective heads out of the sand.
I know the Conclave won't believe us, I said. We'll have to convince them.
It will take the entire city.
He struck my arm.
We only have one chance to build this coalition. If we go with a fire mage and Naeg manifests as a dragon, it will come out that we knew and deliberately kept it hidden.
Then the alliance will fall apart. He nodded.
And when your father comes, there will be nobody to fight him.
A jeep drove away. The blonde driver took the turn fast.
Julie.
Where is she going? I wondered.
Who knows?
As we walked back to the scar, I turned to him.
You should give up and let your mane grow out.
Mm-hmm. And then we can stay up late, and you can braid it and put ribbons in it.
Do you want to show off your pretty hair, Goldilocks?
I'll show you hair.
I raised my eyebrow. Is that supposed to be some kind of threat?
Wait, and you'll find out.
Chapter 14. I hung up the phone and gave it an evil stare. It didn't squeak and flee to hide under the kitchen table. A pity. The light of the morning shone through the windows. The last half of my morning coffee was slowly cooling in my favorite mug. The house was quiet. Last night, we'd gotten in, collected our son from Martha, did the bare minimum necessary to maintain personal hygiene, and passed out, all three of us in our huge bed. I'd had a nightmare that tech hit during the night and ripped Curran apart. I'd woken up in a cold sweat. It took several minutes of Curran holding me for my body to let go of the panicked feeling. Once we got up, George came and collected Conlon, and we split up. Curran went to George's to make Conclave phone calls, and I made mine from our house. I hadn't wanted him to leave. The magic had held through the night. The tech could hit at any minute, yet he acted like nothing was wrong. Nobody knew how much of him was human and how much was God at this point, and my aunt was still out of touch. But spending the entire day clutching at my husband to make sure he didn't disappear wasn't an option. We had to pull the Conclave together, and getting all of the Atlanta bigwigs into one spot was like pulling teeth, only a lot less fun. The phone rang.
This is Amy from Sunshine Realty.
Take me off your calling list or I'll find you and make you regret it. I hung up. Great. I'd graduated to threats now. What kind of sadistic asshole calls the same number 20 damn times in the space of a week, pestering strangers to sell their house? I drank my coffee. This was the first moment I had gotten to myself in days. I remembered I had a great deal of things to sort out, but hadn't gotten the chance to do it while they were happening, and now I just couldn't muster any energy. Curran was now a theophage, like Christopher, only far more gone. He had eaten 6 manifestations of various animal gods. Only time would tell if he survived the tech shift. Thinking about it was like having your neck exposed and waiting for the axe to fall. Julie disappeared after Rowena's rescue. I'd called around to Derek and the guild, and the last time anyone had seen her, she was driving away from King's Row at top speed. She would be back. If she went somewhere, she usually had a good reason for it. A dragon was about to invade the city. A dragon whose brother had slaughtered most of my family. When I finally told Era, she would go through the roof. She must have suspected a dragon was involved, but I doubt she'd guessed he and our ancient enemy were related. That conversation would go well, I just knew it. We had to convince the city that a dragon was invading without any evidence. And my father was still going on the offensive. I felt like there wasn't enough of me to go around. At least Rowena was still alive. I'd done something right. Someone knocked on the door. I walked over and opened it. Simon stood on my doorstep, carrying a large Tiffany-style lamp, the kind that would fit on a side table, in one hand, and a duffel bag in the other. Did you abandon your life of wealth and intellectual brilliance and decide to sell lamps door to door?
Hilarious, he said. I may have a way to communicate with the Suani.
I stepped aside, let him in, and locked the door behind him. Is this more from the David Miller collection? I asked. David Miller was a magical version of an idiot savant, a cruel jest of nature or fate. He couldn't use magic at all, but every object he'd handled during his lifetime had acquired some sort of random power. Simon had spent a fortune acquiring Miller's possessions after the man's death.
No, Simon said. Where is he?
In the basement. Let me go first. I led the way. Adora glanced up from her book, gave Simon a derisive look, and went back to her reading. Simon set the lamp on the side table by Yu Fong and paused, studying him.
What is it? I asked. Quite a remarkable face, Simon said.
Somewhere in my future, if I had one, Simon would show up wearing Yu Fong's face.
Ugh.
Simon knelt, unzipped the duffel, and extracted a roll of fabric wrapped in plastic. He untied the knot and hauled out a small rug, which he placed on the floor. The old rug must have been vibrant at some point, but now the blues and reds of the blooms twisting across it had faded to near beige. Simon took a tea light candle from the duffel and put it on the table next to the lamp. Finally, he produced a small box.
Hold out your hand.
I offered my palm to him. He opened the box and shook a radiant amethyst into my hand. As big as a walnut, the stone pulsed with brilliant color.
Don't let go or you'll break the spell.
Simon pulled a box of matches out.
This lamp came from Cunningham Hospital, a facility in New England that specialized in the treatment of coma patients. Countless people sat by its light and wished with every drop of their being for just one more chance to speak to their loved ones.
All of that energy, all of the love, grief, and sadness poured into the light of one lamp. So much desperation wrapped in it. Will it hurt him? I asked.
The lamp won't wake him from the coma, but if everything goes well, we can communicate with him. The tea light will burn at an accelerated rate. We'll have about 5 minutes. Ready?
Ready. Simon lit the candle. The lamp came on with a click. The cord was right there, wrapped around it. It wasn't plugged in, yet it glowed with a familiar electric light.
Yu Fong? I asked, the amethyst cold in my hand.
Yes,
a clear male voice answered. This is Kate Leonard. You're in a coma in my house. You're safe.
I'm aware of my surroundings, he said.
Okay, then. Is there anything we can do to help you?
The healing I require is beyond the capabilities of a human. Ask your questions. You're wasting time.
The candle was melting before my eyes. He was right. I had to get to the point. Tell me about the dragon who attacked you.
He's insane. We are an old species. There are traditions, rules of conduct. One doesn't just blindly attack another dragon without provocation.
How large was he? Simon asked.
I've never seen one that large. Even my oldest brother can't match him.
How can we kill him? I asked.
How much do you know about the dragon realms?
Yu Fong asked.
A dragon realm is a pocket in reality, Simon said. A fold in the fabric of space where time and physical constraints have different meaning. Frequently, it is hidden in a place that one has to enter. A cave, a palace, a gorge, somewhere. Two separate spaces meet and a boundary exists between the two.
Look at Simon go. A place one can't enter except by invitation from the dragon, I added. As long as a visitor doesn't consume anything, the dragon won't be able to injure them.
But what makes the pocket? Yu Fong asked. What keeps it closed?
I don't know, I told him. An anchor. Every dragon has one. It is an object of great value to them. It can be a sword, a book, a poem on a scroll. Something we treasure beyond everything else. We pour our power into it. We sleep with it. We lick it. We bathe it in our blood and in our magic.
We keep it close. True, time doesn't affect us the same way within our lairs, but time still matters. The more that time passes in the outer world, the stronger the anchor. It is the linchpin on which the entire realm revolves. A dragon as old as that insane asshole would have an anchor of overwhelming power. He can call on it anywhere, and it will bring him home.
Shit. We can't kill him, Simon said. Unless we somehow manage an instant death, he will call to the anchor and retreat to his realm.
Yes, Yufeng said.
Crap, 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 crap. Can we destroy the anchor?
It's an object of great power. If you were somehow to destroy it, the realm would collapse upon you.
That didn't sound good.
You have a book, Yufeng said, about small people. They go to the lair of the dragon, and they steal his ink. The candle went out.
Small people? I asked.
Simon shook his head.
Can we do another session? I asked.
Not now. We'll have to wait at least 24 hours. I sighed.
At least we have confirmation from an independent source, Simon offered.
Fat good it will do us. There were people at the conclave who would insist the dragon was fake while he roasted them with his breath.
Nothing was ever easy. A dragon?
Nick peered at me from across the table. The three knights from Wolf Trap had arranged themselves behind him. Night Striker Cabrera looked at me like I was a spitting cobra. Her hand kept going to her sword sheath, but weapons were forbidden at the conclave, so her fingers found only air. I could relate. Did I stutter? I drank my coffee. I had outlined the events in King's Row and my conversation with Naig. Around the table, concerned faces frowned. We had tried our best to get everyone together in the morning, but by the time we managed to wrangle the powers of Atlanta into River's steakhouse, it was 8 o'clock at night. Normally we met at Bernard's on neutral territory, but we needed privacy, and Bernard's had upscale clientele and had declined to close for the night to accommodate us. Rebecca Rivers shut down her restaurant, posted a member of the kitchen staff at the door, and gave us as much coffee as we wanted, which made me want to hug her. The urge was disturbing. Everyone who was anyone was here. Nick and the Order across from us. Jim, Dolly, Robert, and Desandra to the right of them. Gastek Rowena swaddled into a cloak, the hood over her face. And Ryan Kelly, every inch a businessman except for his bright purple mohawk. The Red Guard, the Mage College, the Witches, represented by Yevdokia with two younger women, both of whom were probably her daughters. The Volves. Thin, gaunt Grigory, his brother Vasily, who worshipped Belobog, and Roman. Teddy Joe and two others representing the neo-pagans, Simon representing himself, and Luther representing Biohazard. Even the druids came, dressed in a pristine white robe, solemn and dignified. His gaze caught mine. Yeah, no matter how well you clean up, I still saw you running around in animal skins in the woods with your body painted blue.
So, let me get this straight, Nick said. Here we go.
I wish you would.
You're saying that a dragon is about to invade us from a magical pocket dimension with his army.
Yes.
And he wants you to be his queen.
Yes.
And, correct me if I'm wrong, but you're technically a princess, are you not?
Jumping on the table and punching him in the face would be counterproductive to building a coalition.
Yes.
Next to me, Curran turned slightly, looking at Nick. I didn't have to glance at his face to know his eyes had gone gold. Nick looked to the rest of the table.
Okay. What we have here, ladies and gentlemen, is a Dungeons and Dragons campaign. The evil dragon wants to steal our princess for nefarious purposes, and she's looking for some knights in shining armor to rescue her.
Nervous laughter ran across the table. Are you done? I asked.
No, I'm just getting started. Have you actually seen this dragon in his dragon form?
No. What makes you think it's a dragon? Philip from the Mage College asked. I've been given information by a pagan faction that states he is.
Which faction? Robert asked.
The druids looked perfectly innocent. Nope, no help there. A pagan faction that wishes to remain anonymous.
I can vouch for this, Roman said. I was there.
You married them, and you're related to her through her mother, Nick said. You're not exactly a neutral party.
The wolves looked like they'd been slapped in the face with a fish.
Are you questioning my son's word?
Grigory thundered. Nick opened his mouth.
We also have confirmation from Yu Fong, Simon said, obtained through magical means.
Philip glanced at him.
Let me guess. Magical means that only you can replicate, that cannot be examined by us at this time because of some technicality.
What are you implying? Simon asked, his voice icy.
The dragon,
Curran said, his voice cutting others off.
Yes, the dragon, Nick said. Has anyone actually seen this dragon?
Do you have any evidence of it?
Philip asked.
Scales, claws.
Rowena lowered her hood. Philip fell silent.
Our condolences on your suffering, Robert said. May I ask some questions?
Go ahead.
King's Row is outside the people's patrol route. What were you doing there?
I was going to visit a friend. I was there on my own time and had taken one vampire with me for personal security.
What sort of friend? Robert pressed.
Is that really relevant?
Gastek asked. Rowena raised her hand.
I'll answer. One of my journeymen died. He left behind a pregnant fiancé. I was fond of him, and I occasionally looked in on her and her daughter.
Were you able to visit with him?
No. She'd had a family emergency and went to see her family out of state. She'd left a note for me with a neighbor.
At least she and her daughter had survived.
What happened next? Robert asked.
When I stepped out of the neighbor's house, there was an army on the street.
You could hear a pin drop.
There were warriors, she said. They wore full armor and they were killing people on the streets. The corrupted creatures served them like dogs. They ran into the houses and pulled the people out.
What did you do?
Robert asked.
I am a master of the dead.
A cold fire flared in her eyes.
I did what I do. I killed as many as I could. Eventually, my vampire and I were surrounded. I realized that I wouldn't escape, so I sent my undead into Inshinar's territory. The warriors then dragged me down the street.
And while they did that, she'd pushed her vampire as far as it could go and made provisions to secure it so it wouldn't slaughter anyone. And when a Yetimur chased her undead, she used her vampire to trap it. Gastek's team had recovered it and secured it in the casino.
I secured the vampire to avoid further bloodshed, Rowena said.
I'd asked her where the pike and the vampire had come from. She didn't know.
What happened next?
Robert asked.
Fire.
We waited.
Fire?
Jim prompted.
A torrent of fire from the sky. When I woke up, I was encased in a pillar of molten glass.
And yet, here you are unburned, Nick said.
That was just about enough.
We were all there, I said. We all saw it. I had to call my father to get her out of it.
The Night Protector leaned forward.
And there it is. All this time you've been giving lip service to how you're getting ready to fight your father, and the moment things turned sour, you ran to Daddy.
I would kill him.
She ran to Daddy because the life of her friend mattered to her, Curran said, just as the lives of all of you matter to her. And because she has enough brains to realize that Naeg made this elaborate trap to prove to everyone that we couldn't match his magic with ours. Now he knows we can.
He raised his hand and counted off on his fingers.
She killed his creatures and rescued Yu Fong. She killed his champion. She neutralized his magic and returned life to King's Row. Has the Order made any progress in identifying the cause of the transformation in the body we sent you?
Don't change the subject, Nick told him.
It's a yes or no question, Feldman,
Curran said.
Yes or no?
Everyone looked at Nick.
No,
he said.
Ha! Huh.
Was the Order able to pinpoint the origin of the magic or find any other similar cases?
No,
Nick said. So you have nothing to bring to this discussion, I said. You're going to sit there and bitch and moan and push your private vendetta. Here's a thought. If I'm a princess, you're a knight, Nick. It's in your title, Knight Protector. How about you put on your shining armor and do some protecting against this dragon instead of relying on the princess to do your dirty work? Nick leaned forward.
You're asking me to accept a mythical creature that nobody has seen for hundreds of years, and which requires too much magic to survive invading us with his magical army. There is a simpler explanation.
I'd love to hear it.
It's your father.
The people and the guild representatives collectively groaned.
Will you stop? I growled at him. Just stop, Nick. Stop. It's not Roland. How do you know? There are two possibilities. Either he is orchestrating this, or you are complicit in his machinations.
Shut up!
Rowena snapped at him.
He has a point, Philip yelled. There is no evidence of this supposed dragon. It is a magical impossibility. In fact, I wrote a paper.
Your paper was hogwash,
Luther cut in.
Precisely, Simon said. I am the Grand Magus. I won't be spoken to like this.
The table erupted in screams.
I'll speak to you however I please,
Luther shot back.
You're a loose cannon, Luther.
Philip shook his finger at him.
It's Dr. Loose Cannon to you.
Evidence,
Nick raised his voice, trying to outscream the others.
You have no evidence, no armor from these warriors, no scales, no evidence. Tell them.
Grigory pointed at Drest.
Tell them what?
Drest asked.
You know what?
Grigory yelled.
I have no idea what you're talking about,
Drest shouted.
Coward!
Grigory spat.
Senile fool!
The druids and the volves banged their staffs on the floor, glaring at each other.
We need to wake Yu Fong!
Philip yelled.
He has actually seen the creature. We can ask him directly.
Over my dead body!
Dolly snapped. Everyone on the pack side looked outraged. On one side, Yevdokia sighed and rolled her eyes. At the other end, Dissandra clapped her hands over the cacophony, chanting,
Fight! Fight! Fight!
I turned to Curran. Do the roar thing. He shook his head.
Not yet. Let them scream themselves out.
The front door burst open. Hugh D'Ambre strode inside, huge in a cloak and the black armor of the Iron Dogs. A beautiful woman followed him. She wore a blue dress, and her hair was unnaturally white.
I'd left my sword in the parking lot.
That was okay. I'd take him apart with my bare hands. Julie squeezed in behind them. My mind took a second to process the fact that Julie wasn't trying to stab him in the back. In fact, she looked like she... like they came in together. Like she went and got him.
Oh, why me? Why?
I couldn't take much more of this. I really couldn't. D'Ambre raised a big bag and emptied it over the table. Metal clattered onto the wood. A skull in a helmet. A pair of daggers. Amulets. Photographs of Pictish symbols tattooed on human skin. I suppose I should be grateful he didn't dump a rotting corpse on us. The table went completely silent.
I've come to help you with your dragon problem, he said.
Nick turned the color of an eggplant. Next to me, Curran had gone completely still.
Well?
Hugh grinned.
Don't all of you thank me at once.
The The white-haired woman smiled and gave us a little wave.
Please excuse him. He forgets about manners sometimes. My name is Alara. You may know me as the White Warlock. I've heard so much about you. It's so nice to meet all of you. I'm Hugh's wife.
The world stood on its hands and kicked me in the face. Hugh D'Ambre had a wife. He owned a castle. He lived in the middle of Kentucky's wilderness. They'd first encountered Naig's troops over a year ago. They'd fought them and developed some strategies. He was glad to share those strategies with us. He had no doubt that Naig was a dragon. He could field 300 of his iron dogs and personally lead them to assist us with this fight. He regretted he couldn't field more, but he'd had to leave a force to guard the castle. In return, he expected the city of Atlanta to help him with some herb sales. Herb sales! I sat and listened to all of it as if I were underwater. It didn't seem real. It was so bizarre, my brain refused to digest it. His wife was the White Warlock. I'd caught Yevdokia's glance once or twice. She didn't seem shocked. The witches had known. Julie wouldn't even look at me. They came in together. She went and got him. Maybe he's married and living happily in some castle somewhere. She had known where he was, and she didn't tell me. I realized the room was silent. Everyone was looking at me, including D'Ambre. He must have asked me a question. I took a stab in the dark.
I need to think about it.
We should adjourn, Gastek said.
Great idea.
Philip reached toward the pile of armor on the table.
No!
Luther slapped his hand away.
Do not touch me!
This is the best evidence we have so far, Luther said. You're not getting your paws on it.
It's not, Simon said, turning to Gastek. He has a live specimen. Luther and Philip swiveled to Gastek. Luther opened his mouth and struggled to form words, but nothing came out.
He's had it for 24 hours and didn't notify anyone, Simon snitched.
The Yetamur is the property of the people, Gastek said.
The three experts screeched in unison like they had suddenly turned into harpies.
Enough!
Curran roared. Silence claimed the table. I turned to Luther. You're the leading expert on infectious magic. I looked at Gastek. You're the leading expert on magic virus-induced transformations. I turned to Simon. You have a wide variety of expert knowledge across several fields. I glanced at Philip. You're a professional skeptic terrified for your reputation. Work together. Gastek looked taken aback.
Oh, you want me to
share, I said. He blinked. Work together. Publish a joint paper afterward if you want. I don't care. Just get me something we can use. Curran rose to his feet. I got up and walked out. Behind me, Hugh murmured,
That went well.
Give them time, Alara said.
Steed,
Hugh said. I stopped. One wrong word to Christopher and I would murder him. Out of the corner of my eye, I could see Barabbas. His eyes had gone bright red.
You survived, Christopher said. You know what they say about me. Hard to kill. I have some things to apologize for.
Come by the house, Christopher said. 303 Forest Lane. We'll talk. I forced myself to resume walking. Curran and I got into the jeep. I chanted at the engine until it turned over, and we drove out of the parking lot. It had rained while we were inside. The city seemed annoyed, like a cat who'd gotten wet. Am I crazy? I asked.
No,
he said. That did just happen?
It did.
Julie went and got him after King's Row.
It appears so.
The city rolled past us.
he walks up to Christopher and says, "Hi," and Christopher says, "Come by my house."
Curran didn't answer.
"He put Christopher into a cage and nearly starved him to death, and now it's all forgive and forget?"
"I didn't forget," Curran said, his face grim. "I remember Mishmar."
I'd almost died in Mishmar because Hugh had teleported me there and tried to starve me into compliance.
"I remember Aunt B," I said.
Curran didn't say anything.
"What the hell did he ask me?" I asked.
"If you would accept his help."
"I feel like I've gone nuts."
"Join the club,"
he said. He braked, thrusting his arm in front of me. The vehicle screeched to a stop.
"What is it?"
"Look."
Straight ahead, a large post-shift building sat on the corner of the city block. The lights were on, and in the glow I could see people sitting at the desks, phones to their ears. It had to be almost 10 o'clock. Who would be calling anyone at this hour? My brain finally noticed the sign illuminated by the Fay lanterns. Sunshine Realty. I turned to Curran. Can we please? My husband's eyes flared with gold.
"Oh, yes."
We left the car running and headed to the door.
"The whole body or just the head?"
he asked, cracking his knuckles.
"Just the head," I pulled magic to me. "Freakier that way."
Curran tried the door and swung it open for me.
"Oh, goody, unlocked."
I walked in. My husband followed.
A young blonde woman looked up at us from her desk. "Hi there, my name is Elizabeth. Are you here to sell your house?"
"Elizabeth, is the owner in?"
"He is."
She put an extra spoonful of sugar into her voice.
"Can you get him for us?" I asked. "Who should I say is here?"
"Tell him it's Kate Leonard." The first pulse of my magic shook the building. "Daughter of Nimrod." A stronger pulse. People looked up from their desks.
"Blood Blade of Atlanta and her husband, the God King, Curran Leonard."
The whole building resonated as if someone had struck a giant gong. Curran's human face broke, and a monstrous lion head appeared on his shoulders. My husband roared. When we got home, Curran went to Derek's house, and I went across the street. George opened the door and held her fingers to her lips. I snuck after her upstairs.
"Where have you been?"
George whispered.
"Derek said the conclave broke up an hour ago.
We had to make a stop."
We didn't kill anybody. After Curran roared, everyone cleared out, and then we had a discussion with the owner about appropriate phone marketing etiquette, calling hours, and the meaning of "take us off your calling list." He walked away on his own power without a scratch on him. But I was confident the unwanted calls would stop. Conlon was in his room, asleep on the bed. Martha lay next to him, curled up around my son.
"Let Mom have him tonight," George said. "She lost him yesterday. She needs this."
I didn't want to leave him. I wanted to pluck him out of the bed, take him home, and snuggle with him to reassure myself he was okay. But he was asleep, and so was Martha. I escaped the house without waking anyone. As I crossed the street, I saw wet tire marks leading up Christopher and Barabbas's dry driveway. The lights were on. I should wait. It was late, even by shapeshifter standards. No, screw it. I marched to the house and knocked on the front door. Barabbas opened it and stepped aside.
"It's for you."
Christopher walked out of the kitchen, a cup of tea in his hands. He was barefoot and wearing sweatpants and a simple dark T-shirt. His eyes were clear, no hint of Deimos, and his pale hair framed his face like a silk curtain.
"Come in. Tea?"
"No."
"I'll get you some chamomile," Barabbas said. "You look like you need it."
Right now, I'd have to drown in calming tea for it to do any good.
"I'll fix you a cup."
Barabbas went into the kitchen. I slipped my shoes off, walked into the living room, and sat on the sofa. Christopher sat in a big blue chair. There was a quiet elegance about Christopher, even when he slumped barefoot in a chair.
"Go ahead," he said. "He put you in a cage. He starved you for weeks. You were covered in filth. I don't know of any person aside from Raphael who has the right to want to kill him more than you. And you invited him to your house. Help me understand this." Christopher looked into his cup. "Do you want to kill him?" I sighed. "No, I don't. I should, because his centurion killed Aunt B, because he broke Curran's legs, and because of Morrow. Curran probably will kill him given a chance. But right now, all I want is to understand you. Hugh kidnapped you and starved you nearly to death. Why don't you want to kill him?"
"Because I met my father. I've trained all my life to murder him. And when we met, I put it aside. My father has the impact of a supernova. He had Hugh since he was a small child. He shaped and molded him, and Hugh had no defenses against that. It was never a fair fight. My father bears a lot of responsibility for Hugh D'Ambre. That said, Hugh is a butcher."
"He is," Christopher said.
Barabbas came over and handed me a cup of steaming chamomile tea.
"Drink."
I took a sip. He landed in a leather chair, pulled a folder from a bag next to it, and began reading the contents, pen in hand. I drank my tea. We sat in silence for a couple of long minutes. I exhaled. The world settled down. "Fine," I said finally, setting the cup on the side table. "Tell me about Hugh D'Ambre." Christopher smiled. It was a small smile, tinged with regret.
"The first time I realized something was off, I had just been made Tribunus, second in command after Morgan, who was Legatus of the Golden Legion at the time. We were in Boston, your father, Morgan, Hugh, and I. Roland wanted to meet with a senator about matters of magical policy. The meeting went well. We were planning to leave in the morning. A hospital across the street from the hotel caught on fire. Hundreds of burned victims, mostly children. D'Ambre went down there. He healed for hours. By morning, he could barely stand. Morgan sent me down there to tell him Roland wanted to leave." Christopher looked into his cup again. "I found him covered in soot, going from child to child, sometimes healing two at a time. D'Ambre told me he wasn't done. Morgan sent me down again, then went himself. We couldn't drag Hugh away from those children. He was manic. By the time we came back, your father was awake, sitting in the hotel restaurant, drinking a cup of coffee and watching the rescue crews. He paid the bill, walked across the street, and told Hugh it was time to go. Hugh told him he wasn't done. He had a boy, maybe 12, and the child had inhaled hot smoke. It burned him from the inside out. Every time he breathed in, he made this whistling, grinding sound. D'Ambre was trying to put him back together. Your father looked at Hugh for a moment and said, 'It will be fine.' Hugh dropped the boy to the ground and followed us out. On the way to the cars, he made a joke about a passing woman's ass."
"I knew that, Hugh. The one who made jokes and stepped over burning bodies. The healing, Hugh? He did save Doolittle. He saved Ascanio, too. But he blackmailed me to do it. He'd killed Mauro. Mauro was my friend."
"For the next 2 years, I was busy with Morgan," Christopher said. "After I killed him and became Legatus, I looked further into Hugh. As Legatus, I answered only to Roland.
I controlled the entirety of the people. I made a study of any potential rivals rising through the people's ranks, and I studied